At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. I am thrilled to be joined by returning guests and friends, Simon Furman and Daryl Lawrence here, and we're going to talk Wolverine in an alternate universe today, during a time when he was very involved in Alpha Flight. Now, the connecting point, of course, we're exploring a lot of Wolverine's early origins on the show as we go by, but Simon Furman, of course, wrote Alpha Flight during a lengthy and incredible run that we've talked about a little bit before, and my friend Daryl Lawrence just released a book called True North, all about the history and analysis of Alpha Flight. Let me welcome you both to the show. I would love to have you introduce yourselves, tell us a little about your name and pronouns, and tell us who are your favorite Alpha Flight characters. When you think about this team, who are the ones that kind of live in your brain as the ones that you love the very most? So let me first welcome the incredible Simon Furman back. Hi, Simon, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me back, Chad. It's good to be here. I'm a writer most associated with Transformers comics, but I've worked on a whole slew of other things, including Alpha Flight. I wrote the North Star miniseries back in the 90s, a slew of What Ifs and a few She-Hulks around then. And since then, I've worked on more Transformers, but I've also diversified into TV animation, did a couple of episodes of X-Men Evolution. I have worked in computer games and continue to do so.
And do you have any favorite Alpha Flight characters?
Yeah, I mean, I was always very fond of that original lineup from this era we're going to be talking about. I think that original team was really good. I loved Puck, you know, was one of my favorite characters. I was never quite sure about genies in bottles and whatever else kind of they tied into his origin, but I really liked Puck as a character. And I think we got to do a little Puck two-parter during my run on Alpha Flight that Barry Kitson drew, and that was great fun to work on.
Really, really delicious. Yeah, Puck has a wild origin story. We'll talk about this character in more detail another time, but there's there's a demonic sorcerer from Middle Eastern mythology called the Black Razor who ends up occupying his body. It's a long story.
Yes.
Let me also welcome Daryl back to the show. Hi, Daryl. We just got to hang out at the Uncanny Experience. I was so happy to be involved with your book launch, my friend.
Yeah. So that was a week ago as of recording. And when this is being released, we will just have seen each other again at FlameCon, where I'm doing another Alpha Flight panel because I have to live my brand with this book. So my pronouns are he, him. I wrote True North. We'll get to that at some point. And interviewed Simon for it. My favorite members of Alpha Flight, I love North Star. And in this comic is probably my favorite North Star panel of all time. I think some of the characters that you focused on, Simon, are some of my favorites too, where it's Purple Girl or Persuasion, mm-hmm. and Laura Dean or Pathway, Goblin. I really like those members because they were new, they were fresh, they didn't have baggage, and you could really explore a lot with them. And Simon, you did explore a lot with them because of the crossovers. A lot of the main team members were taken offline during your run, so you got to explore and give them narratives, which was really cool.
I really enjoyed Beta Flight. It was great fun to have that sort of second tier team, if you like, because it felt like, oh, there's not that much on these characters. We can go somewhere with them.
Simon has been on the show a couple of times. One time was for an episode on the character Wire. Now, Wire, Simon, has been brought into the main X-Men title as on 3K. Have you been following this news?
I have. And, you know, it's amazing. These characters, you think, well, that was fun, but they'll never come back. And they do.
Do you know Jed McKay at all?
I don't.
Oh, Jed's a great guy. It's fun to watch him bringing playing in these like bit villains. And, you know, my show specializes in that especially. So it's been really fun to see Wire in this new place. It's very true to his character. He's back to his kind of hateful mercenary days, training a new genetic team of X-Men to be warriors as he's working with terrible people. So good for him.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's great to see
his powers remain disgusting. Now, Daryl, I was thrilled to be able to conduct an interview with you about your book launch. Now, this was funny because I got a lot of feedback. I came in prepared. I asked some really deep questions. Not only that, but I used a lot of kind of humor and like deep Alpha Flight dives. I asked questions like, fuck, marry, kill, deadly, earnest. I don't even remember the other characters I picked. Land the Sorcerer and who was the third one I chose? Anyway, a bunch of people came up to me after the panel and were like, I came into this panel as Alpha Flight fans, but when you guys were talking, I had no idea who 70% of the characters were. So they went and bought your book, which I think is great because they can learn all about these crazy Alpha Flight rogues galleries. How's it been to watch your book launch, my friend? Do you want to tell everybody a little about True North?
Yeah, so True North is a comprehensive guide of the entire first volume of Alpha Flight. So it's analysis as well as synopses and historical stuff that I pulled from interviews. Like I mentioned, I interviewed Simon and five other folks too for the book. So I got some original quotes and new stuff in there. And it's been really good. The reception has been great. I lurk on Facebook pages for Alpha Flight and people are posting that they're receiving it in the mail and giving good feedback. Like, I couldn't put this book down, which is weird to read when you're the creator and you're like, oh, that's nice. I couldn't put it down either, but that was because I was writing it for 6 months. So it's been really great. People have responded well to it, even though, just like you mentioned, a lot of people picked it up because they want to learn more about the team. And a lot of it remains unreprinted. All of Simon's run, except for the crossover issues, of course, have not been reprinted. So you have to dive into long boxes at comic stores if you want to find these issues, or you can find them online. I mean, there are ways, people. Not that I condone that, but for something that is 30 years old and hasn't been reprinted, there's a little bit of leeway. Just buy it when it does get reprinted.
I think this speaks to all of us, but I know the both of you a little. So before I launched this show, I made a documentary for 5 years. I taught college. I did a bunch of like live storytelling events, and all of those skill sets come in handy when I'm doing something like a podcast or a live panel. Daryl, I know you as a deep researcher. You've done books on Linda Ronstadt and other like musicians. To watch you change those analytical skills from like music and history and apply them to comics has been really fun to watch. I like seeing your skill sets develop. And Simon, I'm sure it's the same for you as you build more skill sets and then, you know, shift from cartoons to television to video games back to comics. It's fun to watch these skills kind of mount. The book is wonderful. And you've been pleased with the reception, it sounds like.
Yeah. And unfortunately, so Simon, it's not available in Britain because Barnes & Noble doesn't distribute to Britain, which is dumb. But the reason that I went with them is because the other alternative for self-publishing is basically Amazon. And I don't feel like I need to feed Amazon any more money. No. So I'm really hoping all the people posting about it with positive reactions gets the attention of a publisher and they pick it up so that we do have wider distribution.
We're going to jump into the world of Alpha Flight here. Now, for the people who are introducing themselves to comics through my show, Alpha Flight has not officially been introduced in the chronology where we're at. We're in like 1975 on the show. It's still a couple of years before we get to their first appearance. But we're jumping into a what-if universe, which kind of takes a lot of the themes. And I like to work some what-if comics in along the way. This was a fun one because this is a book Simon wrote. And we've done other Simon what-if comics on the show previously. For example, what if Mr. Sinister had formed the X-Men, which is a conversation I had with Connor Goldsmith and Teenie Howard. So really fun. It's always fun to see Simon kind of looking at the whole Marvel universe and taking a question and then really diverging the timeline as a result and exploring those big issues. So this one is kind of delightful. Wolverine's history, as we've covered on the show thus far, there's a particular point where there's a lot involved in this, but he ends up becoming kind of a brainwashed assassin for Department H or the Canadian government, which is hilariously corrupt in the Marvel universe, maybe the worst place. This is after Weapon X. This is after the years in the frozen tundra, etc. This is after he runs wild and gets discovered in the woods by James Hudson and Heather McNeil, I think is her or her maiden name. Eventually, Wolverine kind of forms a buddy-buddy relationship with James Hudson, who's kind of a bad guy when you look at his motivation. The government has gathered a bunch of operatives and is putting them together in a certain team. Simon wrote a book called Alpha Flight Special that explores Wolverine kind of leading this team in an early era. We'll talk about that on the show in another time. But then we have the point where Wolverine gets sent by the Canadian government to fight the Hulk in the first appearances of Wolverine. He's called Weapon X. And then in Giant Size X-Men number one, Charles Xavier goes up to Canada and recruits Wolverine. Now, here's an interesting divergence I'm going to go really quickly. We covered a comic book called X-Men Origins Wolverine that expands on that mythology. When Xavier went to Department H to recruit Wolverine, the Canadian government basically put a mutant collar on Xavier and had plans to like capture him and like resource his mutant genes for things. And Wolverine had to slaughter like a whole platoon of soldiers to get them out of there. So when you add that into the mythology, Claremont then a few years later sends the Canadian government Alpha Flight team after Wolverine. There's a giant battle and, you know, Wolverine stays with the X-Men at the end. So we'll get to all of that on my show in good time, but this is where the comic book here diverges. Now, this comes out in March 1994. Simon Furman is obviously the writer. Brian Hitch is the penciler. Joe Rubinstein on inks. Steve Whitaker on colors. Janice Chang, who I've had on the show, who's lovely, is the letterer. Rob Toker and Paula Foy are the editors on this book. Now, Simon, I know you and Brian Hitch at this point in 1994 had already had an extensive working relationship doing books like Transformers and Death Head and even She-Hulk. X-Men fans will recognize Brian from X-Men Prime, X-Factor. He did Age of Ultron and Venom and Ultimates and all kinds of things. I recognize his signature pencils anywhere. Simon, talk to me about your early working relationship with Brian and what it was like to work with him on this book.
Well, sure. You know, when we first knew Brian, I mean, for a start, he was barely 16, I think, when he sent his first samples in. He lived up in Cumbria in the northeast of England. He knew Steve Parkhouse, who's a famous writer-artist over here, and Steve had recommended him to Marvel UK, opened a couple of doors. Brian sent some samples in, and really, they were more Action Force samples. I wasn't the editor of Action Force at the time, Action Force, I should say, is the UK G.I. Joe. So it wasn't branded as G.I. Joe because that's a very American thing. And so it was rebranded as Action Force, toys and comic. And are samples.
For the purpose of the show, we can call it G.I. Nigel.
Yes. And, you know, these samples sat on my desk for a while until our editor-in-chief, Richard Starkings, came in and said, these are good. I could use him. And I said, look, fine. I've got a full quota of Transformers artists at the moment. Anyway, long story short, Brian turned in some amazing stuff on Action Force. I used him on Transformers subsequently. And then we worked together on The Death's Head, where it started as an ongoing series, but basically it was just 10 issues. So yeah, we'd had a long bit of working together and then continued working in the States. And so I was very keen to work with him again. And Rob Tokar was very open to me suggesting an artist if there wasn't one already lined up. I think in this instance, it was one of those ones where I said, oh, I'd really like Brian to work on this. Because at the start, I thought he'd do an amazing job on it.
Are you still in contact with Brian these days? Are you guys still colleagues?
Yes, absolutely. We keep in touch. I mean, we don't see as much of each other, but we do keep in touch and very occasionally we get together. Yeah, you know, I'm still in touch with both Brian and Rob. So, you know, it's all those days, you know, it's not so long ago, really.
Now, Daryl, part of what I'm so impressed with your book is you not only covered Alpha Flight Volume 1, which is 130 issues, but also The Outliers, the limited series, and their appearances in other places. So I know this What If comic and others were some of your research and journey. What was it like to look at Alpha Flight from these kind of other universal perspectives? I'd also love to hear your thoughts on the early origins of Wolverine and how they intersect with the early origins of Alpha Flight, because it's complicated.
Complicated, yes. And in these types of conversations, I constrain myself to Volume 1 of Alpha Flight. I don't go beyond that because then it gets really complicated in terms of what happens with Wolverine, just him. It was interesting to dive into how everything connected with the main series. So if you look at this issue, it's actually relatively early in my book because I have my beater copy that I call it that I can leaf through. And it happens, I think, right after the special in terms of chronology, because it is actually, it's after X-Men 139. So it's after their four appearances in X-Men, because then the timeline diverges. And the interesting thing about this issue is that it was cover dated the same month as the last issue of Alpha Flight of 130. So Simon, you were scripting a What If issue at the same time that you're closing closing up shop on the main book. So this was you getting to play in sort of the Claremont sandbox and take some of those characters you loved writing and get another issue out of them. And the connected issues are such a crucial point to understanding how Alpha Flight developed, not only as characters within the Marvel Universe, but how readers appreciated them and how they really interacted with these characters, because this is really bringing it back to the early days of Alpha Flight when they weren't as fleshed out. You don't have Marina, you don't have Puck, because they weren't invented by Byrne yet when this story takes place. So it's a fun little journey where you're able to see the characters as they are frozen in time right after their initial appearances. And I think, Simon, you nailed the characterizations in how they would react at that time. You're not taking them from issue 130 and how they've matured and developed and died maybe and come back to life. They're fresh. So getting to throw in issues like that to my analysis in my book gives readers more of an idea of how things worked for the characters and the timeline and even the creators as they're putting pen to paper in some way, shape, or form for these characters throughout the entire history up to 1994.
Which is an interesting challenge, because in 94, North Star's out of the closet. There's a lot of things happening. You're wrapping up your run. And to like go back to the early characterizations of these characters must have been interesting. So, Simon, do you want to address that?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I mean, I'm a huge fan of the original Claremont Byrne X-Men's, and particularly those early Alpha Flight appearances. You know, issue 109, is it, the first Guardian, you know, where he turns up as I don't think they called him Guardian even in it.
No, he was Weapon Alpha in that issue.
Weapon Alpha, yes. And then, you know, in 121, 122, that this spins out of, I was, you know, I just thought these were utterly brilliant stories. And I was captivated by the idea of, long before I got a chance to do a what if, it's like, Well, what if Wolverine had stayed with Alpha Flight? What if, you know, they tamed him somewhat and he'd become this asset of Alpha Flight? So I think that was always there from those early issues. And really, when it came to pitch for this what if, I was just like, well, I want to explore that. I want to take him back to Alpha Flight, because it always felt like Wolverine was a slightly better fit with Alpha Flight than he was with the X-Men. And, you know, obviously, for reasons of sales figures and everything, he had to be an X-Man, and I understood, but I was always vaguely unsatisfied with that little bit at the end of, I think it's 122, X-Men, Uncanny X-Men 122, where at the end Wolverine is just in the plane. We've seen him being led off into the armored vehicle, the X-Men take off, and yet there he is in the plane. And I even at the time I thought, that's kind of weird. I'm not quite sure how he escaped and it's glossed over and got into the plane without Cyclops seeing him. And okay, he's a stealthy character, but wow, that would have taken some doing. So, you know, it just felt like a one of those perfect open door scenarios where, well, let's say he didn't get back on that plane. And I think it was always there. And this felt like, yeah, I get a chance to play around with Wolverine, Alpha Flight, X-Men, and even the Dark Phoenix saga, you know, that it laces back into. So, wow, you know, what a golden period that was for the X-book.
There's a lot of recent Chris Claremont limited series where he's taking something like that little moment that you talked about that's like not on the page, and then they're building like a modern limited series that says, here's what happens when you fill in the blanks. So that's an interesting thing to consider in the main continuity as well. Now, Simon, when you came on the show, we got to talk a lot about like shirtless, naked, like wire wrestling with men in the woods. And how kind of homoerotic it is a little bit. We always think of, I think in the 90s at least, we think of like women in shredded clothing, like in certain poses, as very sexual. We didn't think of, queer people did, but I don't think the main audience often thinks of like shirtless, ripped men with chest hair and muscles as like a sexual thing. It's more like, oh, look at how masculine he is. But Wolverine on this cover is hot. He's like, looks like he just got out of the Savage Land. His shirt is shredded. It is all pecs and shoulders and biceps, and he is posed. And it's very patriotic. So we've got the Canadian flag in the background, and the members of Alpha Flight kind of flanked around him. So it's very maple leaf. There's a lot of red. And then the corpses of the X-Men underneath Wolverine, who has his claws popped on both hands. It's a jarring cover. It says, what if Wolverine led Alpha Flight? But inside, the question posited is actually, what if Wolverine had remained a captive of Alpha Flight, which is already an interesting divergence. We open on the Watcher, who has been taking Ozempic and also elongating his spine. This is the tall, kind of hot version of the Watcher. For those that have followed the photos online, our dear friend St. Paul Prince on Instagram did a Watcher look at the Hellfire Gala. It's really creepy and fantastic if you haven't followed. The Watcher has an element of like cosmic space god, but also like tortured. I don't fit the beliefs of my race. But then there's always the element of him is like, this is the creepy guy looking through the window and he's going to watch everything you do. And as he opens with this dialogue, he basically says, look, I could look into any future I want, but I just keep coming back to Wolverine. I'm going to watch him again and again. I love him. Like this is...
To be fair, this issue hit at the exact right moment for Wolverine fever in 1994.
Yep. So you put the word Wolverine on the title. We see Wolverine in front of the X-Men blue team in the background. So this is the kind of a height of popularity. But the Watcher says, look, it's Logan, soldier, spy, X-Man, a hybrid of mutant healing power and science gone awry, his bones laced with unbreakable adamantium, his hands tipped with razor-sharp claws. He is Wolverine. And in this universe, we get the divergence back into that Claremont story we were just talking about, where we get to see Brian Hitch reinterpret that Alpha Flight X-Men battle, in which at the end, it results with Wolverine staying with the team. But in this world, things go a little bit differently. Daryl, do you want to talk about the early divergence in this title and how it changes the timeline?
At this point, Wolverine, like Simon mentioned, is not in the X-Men's jet, and they are going to turn back. So this is an element of the original story where they're like, we need to turn back. That's when he appears in the cockpit, and he's like, hey, Slim, and is like smoking in a cockpit because it was the 80s, so you could.
Smoking a cockpit?
The Canadian military is blowing in a call to Alpha Flight saying, hey, something's going on. Can you intercept this plane? And the message comes in, and on monitor duty is North Star. This is my favorite two panel of North Star ever, where he's getting the call from the Canadian military, from General Chasen's office. And he's like, oh, those other mutants that we just thought, huh, they're circling back and we're being called in to like solve this peacefully. We're not going to do that. And he just clicks erase and just erases the message. So the Canadian Air Force scramble a response and they shoot the X-Men out of the sky. And they're all dead.
Yeah, like this. I mean, you have to tell the story, and this is a divergence that's very quick. But the choice early on to just like this team has survived like reorbit from the stars, you know. But here we just have a couple missiles fired, and the whole team is taken out because North Star got a little catty. Simon, do you remember crafting this early part of the story? It's a wild divergence.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it was just, you know, I had to get the X-Men removed. The spine of the issue is the North Star. Bit of treachery, or however you want to sort of put it, you know, or just, you know, bad temper, or, you know, he's just, you know, it seems very true to the character as he was originally presented, just, you know, someone who isn't necessarily a team player or doesn't, you know, sort of always look to do the right thing. And so, yeah, it was fun to have North Star as the driver for this. But then, yeah, you thought, well, you know, we've seen the X-Men, as you say, escape a million times. You know, they've been shot out of the sky, and I think very early on in Claremont's run, they get shot out of the sky and they all survive this fall from however many thousand feet one way or another. But this time I thought, well, what if they don't? What if they're caught so unawares there just isn't time?
The X-Men specifically killed here are Storm, Cyclops, Nightcrawler, and Colossus. And they just didn't have time, right? Which means Nightcrawler didn't bamf out, Storm didn't summon a hurricane, Colossus didn't have time to change into metal. The missiles hit him at the wrong moment and they're gone.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a little line of dialogue where Storm is saying she can try something to create some extra turbulence outside the aircraft, and it just doesn't get the time. They try evasive, and it just doesn't work. For once, it's a dose of comic book realism where maybe you just can't escape a whole load of heat-seeking, laser-targeted missiles coming at you.
Now, we're going to find out what happens to the rest of the surviving X-Men a little later in this issue, but after they blow up, we jump to Mac Hudson, who is in his full uniform. Dead? All of them. Oh, Lord, you stupid, idiotic, loyal fools. Which is already... Why in God's name wasn't I notified, Chasen? And Major Chasen is a real character from the early Wolverine Origins, who we haven't really seen much since. I could at least have tried to talk to them. At the very least, we could have stopped the X-Men without blowing them out of the sky. Of course, you realize, don't you, whatever chance we had of convincing Wolverine to stay with Alpha Flight was gone for good. Maybe we could figure it out. The message was erased. Who exactly was on monitor duty? So they've chosen to keep this little fact about North Star deleting the message from James. Wolverine's going to find out later. We'll see how he reacts. But they deliver the news to him in his cell. They're dead, and he pops both of his claws. We did all we could, said James. We tried to save them. They wouldn't listen. We had no choice, which is just a bold-faced lie, of course. We murdered your family, is the message being delivered here. None of us fully realized how much you meant to them. Then we see the Alpha Flight team come in. We've got Sasquatch, Snowbird, North Star, Aurora, and Shaman. Long-term listeners of the show are not going to know these characters well, which is okay. We'll talk about them more another time. But they're all a little worried about Wolverine coming on board the team because he's now going to be training them and he is prone to berserker rages. So they're all a little worried about that right away. Wolverine is struggling. Hudson's like, buddy, this is going to hurt me much more than it hurts you. I'm going to have to live with this burden forever. I know your family's dead, but this is my burden to bear. And somehow this works on Wolverine, who has been brainwashed a lot. So he's a little susceptible, I think, sometimes. He's like, you can either help me or you can kill me right now. Wolverine sheaths his claws and says, I should have known they couldn't just leave it be. All right, Jim, if you want me that bad, I'll stay. Whatever home I had with the X-Men, it's gone. And this is a man who is desperate for home.
This is fairly early on in chronology time for Wolverine, even being with the X-Men. You know, he hasn't been with them that long. And I kind of thought, well, again, we've got this unexplored history with the time he was with Department H, the time he was, you know, how well did he know the other members of Alpha Flight? Did he meet any of the other? I just felt it was a chance for us to go, you know, yeah, this was his original family, if you like. This is the one they put him together with first. And, you know, the X-Men was a kind of remove from that. So I just kind of, yeah, the family theme was, yeah, he's a lost soul who's taken in by James Hudson and Heather. So, you know, they were his original family and he's sort of come home to them.
So a little time passes and the team is starting to train together and we get news that a dimensional rift from the negative zone has opened. The members of Beta Flight and Gamma Flight have been captured and Annihilus is threatening the world with all of his crazy insect bugs. We get this crazy space where Hudson is ranting about, like, I can't leave, I'm stuck in my lab. Wolverine, in three panels, lights up a cigar, blows all of the smoke in Hudson's face, and then just tosses the cigar at him as they get ready to go off into action, which is really fun. Now, as far as I could tell, this was not a divergence from an actual comic book where Alpha Flight faces Annihilus?
No, this was a creation for the What If.
So Wolverine, as they're leaving, listen, Jimmy, if we don't make it back, I want you to contact Professor X. Tell him what happened to the X-Men. I figure I owe him at least that much. You sure, Logan? Says James. If Xavier already believes the X-Men dead, buried when Magneto's volcano base exploded, so they've created some sort of cover story, isn't it better to save him more pain, not raise his hopes only to dash them again? So this is James being like, can you please help us keep our war secrets? Because otherwise Xavier might find out what really happened and declare war. Wolverine, yeah, you're a good man, Jimmy. Okay, Alpha, let's do it, which is the launching, and they all jump into combat in the negative zone.
But in this, you know, this is all sort of canon with the X-Men storyline at the time, that there's a point at the end of a Magneto storyline where they think the whole team's been killed, and they grieve them, and then they go off on this sort of round-the-world journey, and eventually, obviously, that they're reunited, and, oh no, we survived. But at this point, the X-Men, Cyclops, Storm are considered dead by Xavier. You know, he's mourned them. So this is a real kind of, we leave him thinking that. He doesn't need to know that they were alive and then died again.
So Daryl, tell us about this this action scene in the negative zone. There's some really fun character moments here.
There are, and this is what I consider a Simon Furman classic, where Simon is really good at expanding Alpha Flight's world and involving other characters. So you can see it throughout the Alpha Flight run that Simon did, and also in this issue, we get Annihilus. So it's very negative zone-y. You get the Kirby dots, Kirby crackles. Snowbird transforms into an owl form to get the rod and, you know, the cosmic control rod.
I adore the just the single image of Aurora punching this big hairy man in the face. It makes me happy.
Yes. The cosmic control rod is captured very easily. So Annihilus is basically a Fantastic Four realm villain. Like, he pops up most often there. He comes back again and again. He's a recurring villain. Those are fun, but they can also be very corny.
Crazy bug space god who has this little control rod that when he holds it, he gets to maintain power. So the heroes are always trying to take it away from him. That's kind of with this guy, if we keep it simple. But you may know him from the Annihilation series in the early 2000s, which is incredible.
And the impetus for this, they need to rescue Gamma and Beta Flight. They're both held captive. So that's why Alpha Flight's getting involved. They triumph. It's the first really successful mission that Wolverine leads the team on. We get to see them in action. It's very short. It's 2 pages, but it's a proving ground for him as team leader, and they go back, and then we start getting a recap of the months that follow for the team.
So my single favorite set of panels in this, Aurora gets to grab Wolverine by the arms. His arms are fully out. His claws are out. It looks like they're doing some crazy like ice skating move together. Like they're jumping in the air, and Aurora and Wolverine in this power circuit where it like flying around and his claws are hitting people. It makes me so happy. But Wolverine, they were afraid of his berserker rages, but he's able to show restraint. Hudson's surprised. A deal? You cut a deal? You, the born scrapper? And Wolverine explains, it's strange, Jimmy. The odds, however stacked, never used to concern me, but somehow with others depending on me for their lives, I suddenly found myself thinking with my head instead of my fists. I guess you got yourself a leader. And then we get one panel that covers a whole bunch of history. Some time passes, and Wolverine is a very effective leader. It looks like they take down the threats of the Master of the World, Arcade, Magneto, the Sentinels, the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. We see Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch here, and Mojo, and they're all here, and I want to... Simon, I think you could come back and do this limited series where it's Wolverine and Alpha in this world just facing a lot of the X-Men's greatest threats. But I like how you will kind of advance the story forward just a little bit. Do you want to talk to us about the story up to this point?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, it, obviously everything has to happen fast. You know, there was a lot of ground to cover in this before we get to the sort of the meat of the story. So yes, there's not a lot of pages of them in the negative zone. But, you know, I'm a big fan of those. Wow. And then we condense a whole lot of time into one sort of multi-image panel. And I thought Brian did a great job of that. I'm really not sure why Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch are in there. I don't remember whether I asked for that or whether Brian threw them in, because they're slightly a misfit at this time in the continuity. They weren't really evil mutants at this stage. They were, you know, in the timeline, they'd been Avengers by this point. So, you know, when I reviewed this, I was a little like, oh, I wonder what the rationale was there. And I'm sorry to say, I can't remember whether it was me or Brian just wanted to draw them.
It doesn't take much for those two to turn evil at any given moment. Right. Now we also advance the story of the X-Men up just a little bit. We get one panel where Hudson's watching the news and it kind of catching up on what's been going on. Now, this is the Muir Island saga that has happened, and it's confirmed that 2 X-Men have died on Muir Island, and Moira MacTaggert has been critically wounded. Now, one of the X-Men that's been killed here is Jamie Madrox. I can't quite tell who the other one was. In the background of that first panel, it says 2 X-Men are dead. We see Madrox dead, and I'm not exactly sure. It might be Siren or Teresa, because I know she was on Muir Island at the time.
Or it could have been Polaris, I guess. I don't know whether she's...
No, because we see her on another page upcoming. So,
right.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure who the second X-Men is. No. But we also see that the X-Men have gone on to handle other threats. And we're going to talk about the team that gets composed here in just a minute. Maybe that was Polaris. We'll get there in just a second.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Professor X is addressing that Jean Grey has been pulled into the Hellfire Club. And he's like, my team is, a little bit spread thin. We don't know who is alive or dead out there. And Jean is turning dark. So she has turned into the Phoenix, which is crazy because we don't know exactly. Well, she had the Phoenix Force at the point when the other X-Men died. So Mastermind has been slowly driving her mad. We're jumping into the heart of the long form Dark Phoenix saga. So now Xavier is asking, can Wolverine and Alpha Flight come in and help for this mission? My other favorite part of this issue is Wolverine training Wildchild, who's a character I love. Simon's work with this character is incredible. He's basically saying, I didn't think Wildchild would be able to do this, but look, he's able to contain his beast. He's telling Wildchild, there's big improvements in your fighting. You're still just a little bit wild, a bit reckless. The trick is to channel that fire burning in your gut. Use the beast, not be used by it, which I think is incredible because we're seeing him really demonstrate effective leadership, which is what Xavier did with Wolverine to help him, tame the beast in the first place. So they are sent into the Hellfire Club. Wolverine and Northstar sneak in through the sewers. And Daryl, do you want to talk to us about what happens between Wolverine and Jean-Paul here?
It's really, Northstar standoffish, as always. Going through the sewers is probably not his style, especially with the man that I don't think that Northstar ever respected really any leader of Alpha Flight in totality. He tolerated Heather eventually, but I can't see him, really meshing quite well. I think in the sewers sees how serious the situation is, that Wolverine is, going for it. This is their mission, and he's exposing his claws, and he senses something within Northstar. So he exposes his claws and he's like, fear. And Northstar's like, am I going to get gutted right now? But he just slashes the power lines.
So then we get Aurora in the powerhouse move again. She's flying her lover, Walter Lankowski, Sasquatch, grabbing him by the armpits and throwing him into the wall. Now, Walter's wearing the tiniest little white shorts, and he has been doing his squats. His ass is muscular.
Yes. She's
throwing him into the wall. He turns into Sasquatch, bursts through the wall, starts fighting off the Hellfire guards. We always get superhero quips, right? Since our invite obviously got lost in the post, I've come to RSVP in person, he says. Donald Pierce is here with his cybernetic hand ready to fight back. They're trading blows. We then jump to Sebastian Shaw kicking Shaman in the face and hefting Snowbird in the form of a polar bear directly over his head.
This is a wonderful page. I actually own this original page from Brian Hitch. It's hanging up in my living room. It's such an amusing one because poor Snowbird as the polar bear is like, what? Just getting tossed around. Wolverine is taking out some goons too in that last panel. So like the whole team is in action.
Shaman, Snowbird, for once forget brute force. This guy drinks it. Sebastian Shaw is, yelling about, I'm just getting stronger and stronger as he rips out of his clothes. But Shaman's able to defeat him by pulling mind stuff from some pixie dust from his medicine pouch. Then we see Harry Leland come in. There is a scene that I can only describe as Wolverine fully pooping his pants. He is doubled over and he's been constipated. And Shaman is struggling as well because Harry Leland's power is to make them heavier. So they are being crushed under the weight, but it's giving full Wolverine sitting on the toilet energy. It makes me really Simon, I can tell you had a blast putting these little fight sequences together. And Brian clearly had a good.
Sure. Yeah. And this is all very much a version of the X-Men issues where they fight the Hellfire Club. So in the real Dark Phoenix saga, Wolverine is in the sewers. Wolverine slashes the power cables. You've got a lot of similar sort of setups with the fight. Yeah, I really wanted it to parallel the actual Dark Phoenix storyline. So, a lot of these are call-outs to what happened in the non-divergent timeline. So yeah, it was really fun to play around with that and do the Alpha Flight version.
So we then jump to Northstar, who his active thought, and Jean Grey can read your mind, but if this is the first thought on your mind, Northstar's thinking, wow, Wolverine's like really tough and he's killed all these people. What if he ever learns I'm responsible for the death of the X-Men because I hung up on them though? He rushes forward and punches Harry Leland in the jaw, so he's diverted as well. And the team is just kind of getting together. Pierce is defeated. They're pulling each other up off the ground, and we see all of the new X-Men team. Oh, it was Polaris that died before, so it was multiple men, and Polaris died on Muir Island. I was thinking she was here. So the new team Xavier has formed of X-Men consists of Havoc, Angel, Iceman, and Beast. And I just can't imagine this is a very effective team with just the four of them. They are all captured and they're being held in stasis basically by the Dark Phoenix. So Aurora shines the light on all of them. And Wolverine's like, oh no, I thought Jean might have been a captive, but we get Jean Grey walking out in her full Dark Phoenix look. This Brian Hitch image is fantastic. Mastermind is behind her and she's in her full glory. Fishnet stockings, thigh-high boots, the black cape, the corset that's tied over her breasts, her hair pulled back like 18th century style. She is looking cunty and sexy and it's the best Dark Phoenix look, right? But like, this is an excellent drawing. Daryl, is it a snicked or a kicked for this look?
Nick, she knows how to wear it. She's fully empowered. She doesn't seem to be, I mean, we know that she's under mind control, but she seems to be more with it, I'd say, than in some of the Claremont issues of the Dark Phoenix saga. Like, she's fully empowered, tragic face that Wolverine gives. I mean, this man.
Genie, oh God, Genie. It's his true love.
Yep. He's super sad. But she quickly transforms. So she does a costume reveal. So
is the Dark Phoenix, which is another gorgeous image by yes. Which is excellent. She looks insane with her hair flowing and she's all red and yellow. She immediately makes all of the Alpha Flight members like assume these like prostrate plank position that all the X-Men are in. They're all just like floating around.
They're working
around
on their abs. Behind her. Yeah, they're all doing a core workout right now.
Mastermind is like, mwahaha, I'm the Black King now. You've defeated the rest and now the Phoenix and I will take over everything. And Wolverine's like, no, it's not Jean. He thinks she's in control. But Mastermind manipulates her into reading Northstar's mind, and then she reveals to Wolverine that Northstar hung up on the X-Men that one time. So Wolverine goes berserker now. You're dead meat! And he slashes claws, and he fully, like, eviscerates Northstar, who is unable to defend himself. Like, it's not viscerally drawn, but the claws have clearly gone fully through Northstar's abdomen and, like, ripped through. And Dark Phoenix is, yes, use those claws, but slowly, my love, flay him by inches. And Wolverine, in his berserker rage, does what he has done in so many comic books, is he fully impales the Dark Phoenix. This is even in the movies a couple times, where Jean is dead with adamantium claws to the heart. As she's dying, oh God, Jeannie, what have I done? She says, what had to be done? That moment when our minds touched the part of me that was still Jean Grey begged you to set me free before the Phoenix power overwhelmed me completely and countless lives were lost. Dear Logan, you have saved me from myself. And as he holds Jeannie, all of the X-Men and Alpha Flight gather around in grief. The Watcher comes in and is like, yeah, so basically Wolverine saved all these countless worlds. The Debari are saved. Billions of lives are saved because he ended the threat of the Phoenix. Simon, talk to us about this beautiful crescendo in the story.
Yeah, it needed real, like everything in this issue, it needed great condensing. I tried again to take the essence of the Claremont issues. You know, the fact that Jean Grey is still in there fighting. You know, there's, I mean, in the end, she commits cosmic suicide in the X-Men 137. And so I wanted that idea that she, you know, that we follow that through, that she is the one, she is the hero who sacrifices herself to save all these billions who are going to die in the future. So yeah, it was trying to take the essence. You know, I really didn't want to tinker too much. I'm too much of a fan of that whole Dark Phoenix saga to have tinkered in the kind of the essence of it. So I wanted that same outcome, that Jean Grey is dead at the end, but she's dead because she contrives to be dead in the end.
But if there's one theme in this story, it's Wolverine has learned how to use the Beast as fuel instead of giving in. Right, the berserker rage is what flips his brain, but it's the Phoenix that did it. And Jean Grey is also trying to contain the Beast within in its own way, right?
The whole thing of Wolverine attacking Northstar, we think it's the berserker Wolverine, but actually it's not. It's the contained Wolverine. He knows what he's being set up to do. Whether this comes across, I don't know, but he actually, although the way Brian draws it does look like he guts Northstar, he doesn't really. When you see the next panel, the end panel, Northstar's still standing around with the others. So it's more or less a sham on his part to get Phoenix close in.
Oh, well, poor Northstar, who gets eviscerated to teach.
Well, I mean, you know, but does he? We see blood fly. We see the claws make contact of some sort.
Sure, sure.
But Brian draws it cleverly, and I'm sure this was in the script, that it isn't a killing strike. It is just to make it look as if he's lost control completely at this stage.
Yeah, this unspeakable tragedy of the death of the X-Men has crafted Wolverine into a more whole version of himself in the long run. So yeah, brilliant. I really love the pathos you put into your stories. You're so good at like crafting a theme in a short issue like this. Very impressive. Every issue of yours of What If that I've analyzed, I'm like, oh, that's so smart. Jump a little forward in time, and Hudson, is his biggest concern is like, oh no, Wolverine's going to leave our team, which is crazy to me. But Wolverine has strategized with Professor X. He still has a full lit cigar through this whole scene. And he's like, you know, basically, I should have left the team. I should have done it months ago. You know, I should have done it without hesitation. Well, maybe enough hesitation to gut North Star on the way out, he says. Except you were right. Leadership has given me a fresh perspective. Soothed the savage beast. I've got a job to do, and it's only part done. I see Wild Child, a reflection of what I might have become. I see North Star, arrogant, stupid, but full of potential. If I give in, I give in on them. I go back to the X-Men. I lose all I have gained. You wanted me, Hudson. You got me, whether you like it or not. And so in this beautiful final page of Full Splash, the Watcher basically says, look, Wolverine stays on as the leader of Alpha Flight. He goes to the X-Men when they need him, and perhaps the world is a better place because of it. Daryl, do you want to talk about the layout of this last page? It's gorgeous.
Yeah, the full team hero shot. You get everyone going into action, and the North Star is in the background the smallest, which is giving more prominence to other team members. And it's the classic lineup. And what I find really interesting about how this story is crafted is that Jimmy Hudson wanted desk duty. He wanted to remain the developer of the technology. He had no interest in being the active leader. So this opens up a new possibility where he's the guy in the chair back at headquarters. And we don't get Heather playing a crucial role yet in this version of the team. So it's him fully just dispatching his crew. Wolverine is the most prominent in this image, charging in and having the rest of the team back him up as they go confront whatever the next challenge may be.
And there's we could do a whole 12 issue series about this world from here. Cause we see Beta Flight and Gamma Flight reference, but we don't see Puck. We don't see Marina. There's a lot of characters that we don't know quite what happened. Outside of Wolverine here, I think the biggest MVP in this issue is Aurora. I think she gets some really fun moments to shine. And there's just some really delicious characterization. Simon, as we're wrapping up, what was it like for you to revisit this issue? It's a lot of fun.
I think the art is gorgeous, as we've talked about throughout. Brian, you know, he's still early on in his career at this point, really. But it's a wonderfully, some issues of comics, you can see almost like, well, that's a good page, that's not such a good page. But the consistency of art in this issue really struck me looking at it again. And, you know, I think, wow, it covers a lot of ground. There's a lot of touchstones with the real Alpha Flight X-Men early continuity. So yeah, I was really quite pleased with it. The only thing I found, I looked online and found the odd kind of review, not exactly review, but more just synopsis and comments. And one of the things I saw thrown up was that at this stage, Snowbird should not have been able to travel outside of Canada. So when they attack the Hellfire Club, she really shouldn't have been able to do that. I think in future Alpha Flight issues, it's stated that she operates only within Canada because of this, you know, sort of mystical side to her.
She also did it in the Negative Zone in this issue.
I think her powers get reduced. The longer she's away from Canada, the weaker her powers are. So it still fits. In my mind, it still works.
Maybe that's why Shaw was able to throw that polar bear so easy.
Yeah, exactly. She's just a weak-ass polar bear in that.
Delightful revisiting. Huge smiles, huge battery charge. Thank you both so much for joining me for this conversation. So thanks, everybody, for listening. I had such a great time doing all of this with you today. Thank you so much. Simon, will you let people know where they can find you online? And is there anything you want to plug for mid-August 2025, my friend?
Sure, yeah. You know, there's a few things I'm working on. For a start, I now do my own podcast. I don't know whether last time I was on, I was doing this.
We haven't talked about it.
But Andrew Wildman and I now do a podcast called The Rest is Giant Robots. You can find it on various platforms, Patreon, and all sorts of other delivery systems. I'm working on a series called Return to Skull Island for Titan Comics, which is King Kong Monsterverse. That's great fun. A second series of Astrobots is due to launch October or November this year. And other than that, I've got various self-published comics coming out, Five Points, a sequel to 5 Points called The Gyre, and To the Death with Jeff Senior. So yeah, lots going on.
Excellent. And where can people find you online, Simon?
Oh yeah, I'm on Facebook, I'm on X, I'm on Instagram.
Yeah, and you were part of one of the most successful comics Kickstarters ever with Transformers. So those are coming out. I imagine I did the G.I. Joe one. So there's a lag in how quickly these gigantic books are produced. But I just wanted to congratulate you on that too, because the outpouring for Transformers was huge.
Yeah, certainly. I think it took everyone by surprise just how well that Kickstarter did. Obviously, this was run by Skybound, who now have the license, and it was deluxe editions of all the Marvel Transformers comics in various combinations. And yeah, you know, it was something in the end about $4.6 or $7 million, which was stunning. So that was good to be involved in, and I signed some book plates for one of the editions for that. And it's been fun to be involved in, and I'm looking forward, I hope, to working with Skybound again in the future.
Excellent. Simon, you're just a gentleman. It's such a joy to have you on. Thank you for coming back on the show. Thrilled to call you a friend, my friend. Have a beautiful day. I appreciate you.
Well, thank you both very much. It's always a pleasure.
All right. Take care. And tell Anna I'm going to look up her books.
Okay, thank you. She'll really appreciate that.
All right, see you later.
Thanks now. Goodbye.
So Daryl, talk to me a little bit about what it was like to format a book like this. There's so many notes and spreadsheets and like pieces of like cultural sensitivity and education spots that you had to work in along the way. And then I would love to hear your analysis of this specific comic book from your book.
So forming it, you've researched things before. For people who haven't done deep historical research or anything like that, you develop a pattern that works for you or a system. And everyone is slightly different. So what I did is that I read everything first, which is great because I'm writing about all these issues. And I also looked up, there's some handy forums online where a ton of Alpha Flight fans have sort of determined the master run of everything. So if you're doing all the 130 issues plus the two annuals and all these tie-in issues, where do they fall chronologically within the universe? Which helped me slot things. So the first thing I did was go ahead, read through everything, type up the synopses and analyses, and then I went back to secondary research and read all of that. So I kept that out of my brain while I was forming my own opinions because I didn't want it to be colored by what someone else may have written or said in an interview or something like that. And after that, then I developed questions for my own interviews. So I read what people had said, and then I could say, okay, well, Karl Potts didn't address this in the one interview I found with him, so I'm going to ask him about this. I didn't want to retread the same ground, if possible. So then I wove it all in. The cultural sensitivity aspect can be tricky, and this is where you need to acknowledge who the creators are, and what perspectives they may have brought to the table, and where their blind spots may have been. You have to think about when it was written, what information they had access to, and sort of the environment they grew up in. If we're talking about Shaman, for example, he comes from an actual nation within Canada. It's an actual First Nation.
The Sarcee, nation. Right?
They are the Soutina now. They have their own website. You can look them up right now and figure out where they were geographically, what lands they inhabited, and their belief systems. But the internet didn't exist in the 70s. You also have to look that John Byrne was of an age growing up when what was a really big thing on TV and even in comics, cowboys. And you have to apply that sort of thinking to how some of these characters are being written, then how they change throughout time under different writers. So it was a hard thing. I didn't want to do a deep dive on research in terms of confronting and flipping that. I included a passage in the introduction saying we need to acknowledge that these creators are not perfect. And there are some things that if we assume best intent, they tried, they did their own spin on something they may have read in an encyclopedia or other reference material. At worst, they just straight up made up this shit. For storytelling.
I believe that a lot of these people had ill intent, but there are a lot of times when people just didn't put in any kind of research and they used their own kind of cultural bias to inform how they saw a certain character, right? So when you view something like a Native American character through a white colonial lens, those stories come out a particular way. So I think that's always important to put into context.
It's a big thing that you need to confront. And especially now when you look at Canadian culture and the reconciliation movement and boarding schools, everything that's wrapped up into it, it's very complicated. And some of those colonialist, I guess, mechanisms, very, very, very harmful. And they did a lot of damage. And we still see the outcome of what those decisions were 2 centuries ago, 3 centuries ago on the First Nations today. So I wanted to give the characters their due as much as possible within the framework of how they were written and analyzing it there. I cannot tell you how many times I typed the word medicine bag when it came to Shaman, because that's his power. He can draw things out of basically the nexus of all realities. That's where everything is coming from. It's from the negative zone nexus, however you want to term it. That's where he reaches in, and his power is being able to find what he wants from it. And elsewhere in the episode, I've addressed Wolverine was red hot, and this gave Simon Furman the opportunity to really work with Wolverine. Wolverine really didn't factor into his run at all. You got elements of it. And I know you covered this in the Wire episode with Simon and Scott, where you had the new Weapon X, the 90s Weapon X, who...
Garrison Kane, yes.
Garrison Kane is such an element of the 90s. You also have Wire. So you had sort of ciphers for Wolverine that were still woven in, like the gruff, buff men that have a chip on their shoulder and need to prove something and love slashing things. So he covered that. This gave Wolverine a spot to shine within Simon's writing. So it was a place that I think was very smart. I don't know when this was written relative, like I don't know where it was scripted relative to issue 130. They both came out the same month. And the interesting part of how Alpha Flight ends as a series, it's not a happy ending. We get a lot of happy endings now when series are ended. We get the last splash page with everyone all happy together. They're like, this is great. And Alpha Flight doesn't end that way. The team is disbanded. And they're basically set up for whatever, and this is my applied analysis, that future writers may want to use. They wouldn't have to go in and dig someone out of a team. The team was broken up. So Simon, in that last issue, separated everyone. And that's how he could do a North Star miniseries directly afterwards. So the characters were available. The interesting thing about this issue is that I think Marvel could have done something more with it. If they wanted to continue with this universe, they could have probably sold a decent amount of books with Wolverine heading Alpha Flight in an alternate timeline. That it's a very compelling and tantalizing possibility, and that's what what-ifs are all about. You want to draw the readers in and say, what if this happened? And by and large, most of them, you want more out of that. You're like, no, Watcher, don't come in at the end and end this. I want to read more about this. And when I interviewed Simon for the book, he said that this was one of the highlights of him writing Alpha Flight was this issue. This issue and also Special Number 2, which has the hunk St. Elmo in it. So, and you won't do a Patreon on St. Elmo. I take great offense just because he's only had one appearance ever.
Could combine him with some other characters, but
we could do a
one appearance character. There's not enough.
I know.
At least it's like a certain character. It's like the fucking lot of story. But yes, I like St. Elmo. This is himbo daddy energy.
Yes. So the other thing that stuck out is how Wolverine is written here. He is neither mopey nor berserkery in this issue. And those were really his two modes in the mid-90s. It was one of the two where he was either super depressed or he was just slashing everything around him. This is a different spin on the character that I really appreciated because naturally, I do not gravitate to Wolverine. It's not one of my favorite characters, but the way this Wolverine is written is compelling.
I'm really learning to love Wolverine more and more as I make the show. The oversaturation is also a real thing, but he's a lot of fun. Okay, Daryl, thank you so much for joining me today. Where can people find you online? Anything you want to plug for August 2025? And when this comes out, we will literally be hanging out in New York or have just finished hanging out in New York, which I'm very excited about.
I'm very excited about too. So I first of all, very sorry for anyone who was not at FlameCon, because I'm sure that our panel on queerness, otherness, and sexuality in Alpha Flight was just fantastic, and everyone loved it. I know that they did. People can find me online on Instagram and Blue Sky under @MacOnFleetwood. It's like Fleetwood Mac. It's a pun, and it fits because my next book is about Stevie Nicks. You can also follow my podcast, X Factor Files, on Instagram @XFactorFilesPodcast.
All right, everybody. Lastly, I am Chad Anderson. I keep my own social media private because I got kiddos, but you guys can follow me, Daryl and Simon, if you don't already. You can follow the show, however, at @GrayMalkin_Lane on Instagram, most prominently. Watch for some really fun content coming out on the show. The very next episode after this is going to be the trial of David Cannon, the Whirlwind, who is a crazy character, an early 70s mutant, early 60s mutant, actually, one of Marvel's first, who never has much to do with the X-Men, but it's going to be a really fun time. We just got to do the script readings with him over in the Avengers, just going crazy. It's watching. And stay tuned right after this for another conversation on the Red Skull.
And now stay tuned for some thoughts on fascism as a special guest and I talk about a Red Skull story and its modern applications. In 1935, Adolf Hitler and Joseph Goebbels commissioned a film to be made called The Triumph of the Will. They hired Leni Riefenstahl, a former actress and dancer who now worked as a rare female film director for the time. Using sweeping aerial shots, crowds full of cheering extras, and low camera angle shots to portray a sense of power, she portrayed Adolf Hitler as a messianic savior for the German people, there to guide what was called the Nuremberg Nazi Party Congress. The film ended up traveling around the world and was known as being very ingenuitive, and it won several awards, even in the United States, as Hitler was slowly rising to power and the intent of his message began to become clear. Now, we'll talk more about this later, but contrast this with Charlie Chaplin's film, The Great Dictator. Leni Riefenstahl did make another film at this time called Olympia in 1938 in order to document the Berlin Olympics, which heavily promoted messages of Aryan superiority as she began towing the party line more and more. Leni Riefenstahl was known at the time as the most influential female director in the world. However, she never officially joined the Nazi party, and after the fall of Hitler years later and the exposure of concentration camps, she was never officially charged with any war crimes, although she was held accountable multiple times. She was never found guilty. She did, however, struggle to retain fame after this because people rejected her worldwide for her work as Hitler became known as the most evil person ever to exist. Leni Riefenstahl, by the way, lived to be 101. Over in America, in the years 1942 to 1945, the true purposes of the Nazi message were now very clear around the world, especially after the bombing of Pearl Harbor locally, and legendary director Frank Capra, who had made films like It Happened One Night and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, made a series of films called Why We Fight. You can find these on YouTube, promoting American values and putting forward the ideological differences between democratic values and Nazi values. These films were educational and made very complex political situations much more digestible and easy to understand for the American public and the military. It was shown to troops as they prepped them for combat. These films often used footage from Riefenstahl's own work that had been German propaganda. American propaganda films, even comic books at the time, which we've discussed, frequently portrayed German and Nazi soldiers and leaders in cartoonish and racially insensitive ways, making them appear to be foolish, greedy, power-hungry, and lazy, but that compared nothing to the way German propaganda films portrayed the Jews, the Slavs, and the Roma as beasts of burden, as rats. But America also had a dark history of doing this with Black and Brown people in their own propaganda films. All right, we're going to jump to 1978. Captain America is on the hunt for the truth about his mysterious past because he got kind of brain damaged and weird things happen when you're in an iceberg for decades. Don Bluth and Sal Buscema are on the story here. They're here to give us the real Captain America story, one of about 30, if I am honest. Cap's search takes him to Newfoundland, of all places, where he fights some heavily armed men in purple and yellow before meeting a man that he had fought actually decades before. This is a new character for this story. A man whose voice sounds like, quote, some weird combination of Erwin Rommel and Boris Karloff, end quote. This is a Nazi spy named General Lyon. wild Decker. Decker has a secret base underneath this remote Canadian territory where he has constructed a giant 12-foot Captain America robot lookalike. So we get a flashback to Captain America and Bucky during the war where they meet Lyle Decker, who works for Democracy Pictures. He's making anti-war propaganda films with a crew of colorful characters, including the very flamboyant Whit Spencer, who is so gay. A guy named Glenn Reaper plays Cap himself in this film, but then Reaper gets wounded because there's real bullets loaded into a fake gun, and Captain America has to step in to play himself in this war film. A poster on the wall advertises the real radio drama from 1941, Dick Tracy versus Crime Inc. You can look it up. Anyway, Decker is, of course, working for the Red Skull, and he's been sabotaging things. They want to ruin Cap's reputation like always, and he plans to kill Captain America in the final film with a Nazi heat ray. Of course, Decker is defeated at the end of this. Now, back in the present, Decker explains that after his supposed death decades before, he had tried to escape his obligations to the Nazis on a German submarine, but the Red Skull had been waiting for him. Decker was tied to a chair, beat up by the Red Skull, and then jettisoned into the ocean and left to die. But he washed up on the shores of Newfoundland and was taken in by a very, really nice family. This is very Come From Away for those of you that know the Broadway show. He built a new base of power with new criminals, and it turns out when Cap's plane with Bucky dropped into the ocean with the whole iceberg origin story, Decker was involved in that process. And they had pulled Cap out of the ocean before the iceberg happened. Cap had fought back, and then an explosion, and then the iceberg. There's about eight of these stories that are the interim between Cap and the iceberg. It's kind of crazy. So Decker has been waiting for decades for Captain America to show back up. Sliding timescale be damned in this story, and he drains Captain America's abilities into the Ameridroid, that's the name of his 12-foot Captain America doll, to amplify its powers, and then he transfers his own mind into the robot itself and his personality, which then leaves his now, like, old man Nazi body dead, and he now lives in a 12-foot Captain America mannequin animated. Then Steve Gerber comes aboard to finish the story. The first thing this Ameridroid does is announce a new world order in Newfoundland, saying that he now rules and he's declaring martial law, but his mind is immediately overwhelmed by madness and self-hatred. What have I done to myself? My human body is there before me and I'm trapped in this 12-foot Captain America doll. He smashes everything. I'm gonna skip through to the end, but he and Captain America end up making peace. And at the end, the Nazi in the 12-foot Captain America body, called the Ameridroid, goes on to find himself. We will discuss this guy in another story upcoming, because he returns with the Red Skull soon. Let me invite my friend Erica Schultz to this crazy conversation with me. I'm going to assume you had never read this story before, my friend. How are you?
I'm very well. Yeah, I mean, I have read Cap. I have like some of the Cap compendiums, but there's gaps amongst them. And also, as you had mentioned, there are so many retcons with Cap. Like, and there's even a lot of retcons with Bucky as well. So yeah. Like, there's, I think with these characters that are so old, they're just sort of twisting. And it's like, you know, the secret lives of Captain America or the secret adventures of Captain America and things like that. So there's like always ways to sort of like insert these strange little, you know, side stories, side quests. This was a very strange story. And it was...
I was picturing you going like, what the fuck are you having me read?
I was, well, that's why I texted you in the middle being like, are you sure that this is the issues numbers? Like, are you sure it's the one from the 70s and not the one from the 90s? Because I remember like Red Skull possessing Sharon Carter in the 90s and then Sharon going after.
We'll get there. We're still in the 70s.
But I was like, wow, this is some weird, weird shit.
So let me ask you a few questions and we'll cover the story as we go. First of all, are you a Red Skull fan?
I'm not a fan of fascism and Nazis. So no, I think that he is definitely a product of the time. Because, you know, when Cap was first written in 1941, that makes total sense. I think the fact that he has stuck around for so long is... you know, sadly, a product. I mean, sadly, he's more or less a mirror of what's happening in the United States and the world right now in terms of the, I won't say the rise of fascism, I would say the re-rise of fascism and these very nationalistic sort of alt-right kind of governments that are popping up everywhere. But I think that as a character, he makes perfect sense for somebody like Captain America, because Captain America is supposed to be, unless you're going nomad, Captain America is supposed to be the paragon of truth and justice, you know, very much like Superman in that sense. And then there's no way of arguing that the Red Skull is good in any way, shape, or form. So the fact that you're like, there is no gray tone to this bad guy.
Yeah.
I think that that's one of the reasons why they keep pulling him out and bringing him into these stories, because it's like, there's no nuance.
He's the barometer, the baseline barometer for evil in the Marvel Universe. Even characters 100%. Like Baron Zemo, Baron Strucker, you can find some redeemable qualities in a way, but Red Skull is the epitome of hate.
Even Dr. Doom can find some redeemable qualities.
Well, yeah. Dr. Doom is a dictator who likes attention. He's a narcissist, but Red Skull is the concentration camps, right? Like it's a different level of horrible. We actually, in one of these conversations, have a Dr. Doom Red Skull comparison, because they fight a few times in the 1970s, which is crazy. Red Skull tries to conquer Latveria and it doesn't go well, of course. Now, in this story, Red Skull plays kind of a minor role. It's only a flashback, but this spy who fails, he then gets tortured, beat up, and jettisoned into the ocean, which is always what happens when you let down a fascist, is they spit you right back out, which we're seeing in the Trump presidency over and over again.
But in the torpedo tube, mind you. It was the torpedo tube that shot him out.
But let's talk about the character of Professor Lyle Decker. What were your thoughts on this fella? He's kind of fun.
He talks.
As far as Nazis go, he's kind of a good time.
He's kind of a good time. And you know what cracked me up is the fact that he was so invested in being this special effects artist. He was building all these models and he was doing all this crazy stuff. And he was so invested in Democracy Films, which was the name of the film company. But he played a long game. This was a very long game, you know, aside from just the 30 years of waiting for Steve to come back to Newfoundland, but putting together your resume to get a job at Democracy Films, to then start being their special effects guru, to work on all of these films, and then finally for Steve Rogers to maybe perhaps show up so then you can knock off the stunt performer who was playing Captain America. There was a lot of pieces and parts to this scheme of his.
Well, and that was before the decades in Newfoundland waiting for Cap to show up. Like, eventually he'll return, and he must.
He has to.
What are your thoughts on his big plan here? Initially, it's the Nazi assignment of besmirching people through propaganda films, which we'll talk about in a second. But then the modern application, and this is a character that's come back multiple times, he creates the Ameridroid. What do you think? What do you think of the Ameridroid and what he represents?
I think the Ameridroid, sadly, nowadays, the Ameridroid is kind of how many other countries view us right now. You know, this larger than life, very, we're here and we're, you know, we're going to tell you, other countries, the rest of the world, what to do. We're the ones setting the rules. And that's kind of what I felt like, you know, and he, Decker even says, he makes this comment where he says, like, you know, I am all of the things that you, I am all of the things that you are, Captain America, but amplified. I am twice your size. I am, you know, twice your this, that, and the next thing. And
it's literally, let's get out the measuring sticks and I'll show you I'm better than you by being better than you.
But being bigger.
Yeah. But first I have to drain your skills into the body, right? We've also had conversations, because this is a recurring theme for Red Skull, he is obsessed with mind controlling Captain America or projecting his mind into Captain America. Later, Arnim Zola makes Red Skull a Captain America clone body that Red Skull lives in, right? Like it's his form. There's this idea of like veiling fascism in the guy of giant democracy, which is so thinly veiled here.
This was written, you know, 45 years ago, give or take. And the fact that, when this was written, you were coming off of Nixon and Watergate. And in 77, Carter came into office trying to, you know, and I put it in air quotes, fix things. And yet people, you know, talk about how big government isn't the answer. And yet here you have a literal giant representing the government. Because yes, even though Captain America is still considered a, you know, a freelancer, for lack of a better term, he is still the physical embodiment of what the U.S. government is. He's wearing the flag.
Kind of what we're facing these days in a very oddly veiled way. We're punching a giant 12-foot Captain America who's just going to stomp on us if we don't do something.
Go for his balls. Big metal balls.
Do you think Lyle Decker gave the Ameridroid working genitalia?
No, because he makes a comment that he's never going to know the love of a good woman anymore. But I mean, like, could you imagine being in a relationship with him? He's like, even if you were a woman crazy enough to get into a relationship with this man, his obsession with Captain America for 30 years, you wouldn't be able to have a relationship with this guy. So whether or not the Ameridroid had working genitalia or not, it doesn't matter. This guy is so obsessed with Captain America.
That even if he does find a 12-foot woman out there.
That's why I find a 12-foot woman out there. It's not going to help because he's still obsessed with Steve Rogers.
The other large theme in this story is, of course, the kind of propaganda films. And this is something that we've seen across history in America and in fascism. And this is, again, fascism as the enemy of democracy. Now fascism has become democracy. It's always been uncomfortable, right? But now it's very much in our face. But the idea of the propaganda film, we're going to make political messages that turn you against the things we are against in order to get power. Because while you're looking over there, we get the power and resources. But also, whatever anyone else is doing, the democracy pictures, films in the 1940s that were pro-cap, we're going to come in and we're going to ruin those and show you it's broken, which is weirdly the Trump fake news approach, right? Like, let's send the Nazi agent in to change the message so people don't trust the message any longer. Again, a silly story, but that through line is deeply uncomfortable.
And it's deeply germane right now because I was watching something the other day about AI slop. It was on John Oliver, and he made a very good point that people being suspicious of AI makes them then suspicious of things that are actually factual. And the fact that the idea is it could be AI, but even if it's real, I'm not going to believe it. And that sort of making you second guess or no longer have faith in reality, in facts, in anything. That just basically makes us all sort of float around like jellyfish. And if we can't see it with our own eyes in person live, then there is no objective reality. And that is really, really dangerous, you know, just in general, not just for democracy, but for law, for anybody's experience.
Yeah, yeah. You referenced the Nixon story. We've covered that on my show, the secret empire, the hooded men, and it leads to the Nixon in the White House and Cap forsaking his country for a period of time, right? We've talked about that because the Red Skull's involved in getting Steve Rogers back to being Captain America later. But there's another group running through the Cap comics at this time, which we won't explore a lot, but you guys can look it up on the Marvel Wiki if you like. There's a group called the Corporation, which is basically just a secret alliance of evil, rich businessmen run, like including like politicians and corporations that are influencing events and hiring supervillains and doing all these underground things, right? There's a guy named Eugene Kligger Stivak that's like the point person for that in these stories. So Cap is always fighting this, but then the Red Skull rears his head again and again. Erica, do you have any final thoughts on the Ameridroid story?
It's very, when I emailed you and I was like, why did you pick this of all ideas? And then it like kind of dawned on me like, oh, duh. It's shining a mirror on exactly what's happening today. I do think it's kind of funny, though, at the end, he sort of goes off into the forest, and it kind of reminds me of like how Logan used to like retreat to the forest to find himself, or even the old Hulk stories where after there was this big battle, he would then sort of retreat into the forest to sort of like, you know, calm down, you know, and such, but also to sort of have some self-reflection. I really hope the Ameridroid finds himself a nice 12-foot lady.
You can go to the Marvel Appendix. This guy's whole history is up there. Lyle Decker, the Ameridroid. But we will talk about him in a few more episodes. He comes back to work for the Red Skull shortly. It doesn't go well. We'll get there. And again, the message of, you know, let's tell a superhero story about Nazis, but make it kind of playful
useful and fun. The Ameridroid's the perfect example of how to do that, because the Red Skull sending people to concentration camps is much less pleasant, and we're going to get plenty of those stories as the time goes ahead. Erica Schultz, I love you madly. I think you're incredible. Thank you for hanging out with me today.
Thank you so much for having me on again.
All right, everyone, we'll see you back here next time. Thank you for listening to Grey Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Grey Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Grey Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Grey Malkin Lane.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.